You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy.
Hi, I'm Jody the Mom.
And I'm Dr. Barr the Doc, and this is Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with a special emphasis on homeopathy. Today, we are very excited to welcome a guest to talk about something that is related to homeopathy, but also just related to pans, pandas, and autism in general, and that's vaccines. And we are very excited to welcome Dr. Taylor Bean, who is a naturopathic doctor. She is somebody who has been very vocal in our community, the naturopathic doctors who really focus on this community. She is a fellow of the Medical Academy of Pediatric Special Needs and has presented at conferences talking about this topic. And so just having listened to her recently at a conference, I wanted to snag her and have her come in and talk to me, in part because we have similar ideas about how to approach vaccines in that we tend to take a really, really moderate and thoughtful approach. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce her before we dive into letting her tell us all about everything. So Dr. Taylor Bean has always enjoyed learning the uniqueness of the human body, how each system, be it anatomical or emotional, plays an intricate role in maintaining the strength of our body. With her patients, she is passionate about discovering what part of the system is responsible for creating imbalances, to dig deeper than the surface and to look at all aspects, ultimately finding the missing link. Each and every person will have different reasons for bringing on ailments or disease, and it is her job to discover what part needs a bit more attention. She is currently licensed and in good standing with the College of Naturopathic Physicians of British Columbia, the CNPBC, along with completion of her prescription authority through the CNPBC. Welcome, Dr. Taylor Bean. We are so excited to have you here.
Thank you for having me. This is great. Yeah.
Let's get started by just telling us a little bit more about yourself and what drew you to naturopathic medicine and wanting to work with this community in particular.
Mm-hmm. So I graduated in 2012 as a naturopathic doctor, and upon graduation moved overseas to Dubai. And then we left and went to Singapore. And in Singapore, my first child was born. And Singapore has mandated vaccinations to go to school, so diphtheria and measles. So as a new mother and a new doctor, vaccinations were actually not, I did not know anything beyond what is taught in school, which is similar, if not exactly the same, as what medical doctors are taught, which is timing and the infections. Here's the schedule. And that's essentially it. And then you'll get into the infections themselves. But in terms of the vaccine realm, that's all you're taught. When I was in Singapore and started my practice, I had two families on different occasions come in with questions around vaccines. In Singapore, you can see specialists very quickly. You can see anyone that you want. Their medical system there is excellent. They, however, were not receiving the answers to their questions. And I was sort of the new person on the block, and they came to see me, and I had no idea what I was dealing with. It was a child that had been vaccinated, and they were seeing differences and changes in their kiddo that weren't acute. They had been lingering, and it was more so, we need solutions. We want to get our kiddo back to how they were previously, and what is it going to take? And to me was, I don't even understand what I'm dealing with. We have a vaccine with an antigen that elicits memory, and that's it. So as a naturopathic doctor, what am I doing? So of course you pull in your principles and you're utilizing things to support the body. But I don't get it. I don't understand the mechanisms at play here. And my colleagues didn't have answers. It was more of, well, you should just do this. Yeah, but why? But what am I dealing with? So it was the second time it happened and I didn't have an answer. What came over me was I was actually embarrassed that I didn't have an answer. And so I took it upon myself to learn more. So there was a bit of information out there, but still wasn't enough, but it was sort of building blocks for me. I created a three-part vaccine webinar at that point, then moved back to Canada, and I took the certificate so that I could administer vaccines in my office, about a 16 or 17 module program that you need to take, and thought that I would, you know, gain, you know, answers from that. It was just, you know, again, how to administer, when to administer, how to make sure the vaccine, the cold chain process. And so I was hungry for more. So then I just continued and continued. And so I've probably taken every single vaccine course that's offered. I've attended the conferences that are out there for answers. I've now created my own webinar series and lectured to stimulate conversation and be it someone out there has something, you know, more to give me. And it's happening. I think I'm gaining the momentum now more so because there's more people talking, more people looking into vaccines that now that I can have that's tangible, that I can be like, aha, this is why maybe this happened. And I look at the adverse reactions that are listed within even my BC CDC and take that as, well, why is that listed? Why is this issue or adverse reaction listed? How would it have led to that? And it's not just a fever or pain at the site. It's more of these neurological components that they are listing. So to me as a naturopathic doctor is if you're listing that as a potential adverse reaction, how could I prevent that? What am I doing to prevent something like that, that you have listed as an adverse reaction that potentially could happen? So that's basically where it led me, you know, learning from my patients, queries from them, me not having answers, my colleagues not having answers that were good enough for me, that have, I'm just like, okay, well, I'm going to take this and go with it and see what happens. And amongst that has been creating a safe place for parents to come to ask their questions. That's probably 50% of it. Because what I've found is that parents that are shamed for their questions, and these can be just simple questions like, can you split the MMR vaccine? When you're shamed, you don't return. You don't want to have that conversation again. And what happens is you stop or you don't do anything. So that's where hesitancy is born. And that's where I think the primary place that hesitancy has occurred is from the conventional side, unfortunately. And because we all like to play blame games. And part of me is like, I don't want to blame, but just let's speak rationally here. And if you are going to shame someone, don't expect them to come back. And now I have that patient 5 years later who decided to do nothing because they were traumatized in that first experience. And now they're like, well, I think you're one person I can talk to without being yelled at. And that has happened hundreds of times. And it hurts me to my core every time I hear it and the language that's used out there. Don't expect someone to listen to you when when you're using really hurtful or scary language. So that's what's that keeps me going, because it's just each vaccine consultation that I have with parents, you know, they it's an opportunity for them to speak, because that is how we obtain informed consent. And part of vaccine administration, part of obtaining informed consent is the opportunity to ask questions. And I take that very seriously. It's not going to happen within 5 minutes. So be it that conversation with your healthcare provider should be multiple times, and you can go when you're pregnant. You can go before the kiddo is supposed to have vaccines at 2 months. You got lots of time, but you don't know that you have questions until the day comes. So and social media has really been a platform for questions. I see wrong answers on both sides. Both sides, there's wrong answers. And that's where I'm trying to educate on both sides. You know, actually, it's this with evidence, with rational discourse. And so it's such an interesting topic because, it's challenging to discuss. Parents have really good questions. You know, I've had parents almost sweating. They're shaking when they first come in. I'm just like, I am so sorry that this has been an experience for you that is literally traumatizing. So we don't talk about it right away. We sort of go through a sequence of questions of how's your pregnancy and how was your labor? And we go into it. And then we get into the core of those questions, and they send me their questions beforehand. So you already kind of have a have something to work with, tangible, of what is it that you want to know? What is it that no one's answering? What is confusing? And so I have patients that want to, have to, and I have a lot of patients that vaccinate with me, and we just do it in a way that works for them, whatever that is. Patients that come in, their kids are 5 now, their kids are 1 year, they're 15, you know, it's all different. Kiddos that are unvaccinated going to college. So it's, you know, I just start where they want to start and go from there. And it's a beautiful process. When you work with someone and your patient from a very calm, respectful place, as we should be, we really get things done in a conversation. So, yeah.
No, I think it's beautiful that you point out that when you go with questions and you get shut down, that it really shuts you down and it makes you feel less trusting of the process, because it's appropriate to question things. And I know that our listeners and the PANS PANDAS community as a whole, and the autism community as well, that they get shut down by so many people, and that people are just denying their experiences. And then even to the point where they're outright like accusing a parent of Munchausen by proxy because of they don't understand their experience or because of the reaction that a parent is having to the chaos that's occurring in their child's body. So you're absolutely right that like not being open to conversation can create mistrust in something that maybe somebody would be more open to or willing to explore further or choose selectively what's right for them, when versus like when they get shut down, it's just, nope, I can't do this because there's clearly a reason that they're not willing to talk about it.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Exactly. So
yeah.
I feel very much like you just talked to me without knowing me very well, which means you spoke to a whole lot of moms and dads in this community and being frozen. And I think even now my daughter is, you know, recovered from PANS, but I'm still frozen back in that space where even before we got on earlier today, I was having a conversation with somebody and I'm like, I'm even uncomfortable about talking about this right now. And it's very much because I am frozen back there in that space of not knowing what questions to ask, having, you know, the few questions that I did ask met with such strong unkindness. And it just I didn't even understand that until you just said it. It just freezes us in that space to where we don't even know what the questions are or what the conversation needs to be anymore. So,
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the reality is there's so much studying that needs to be done. I know that when I had my daughter, when I was pregnant with my daughter 4 years ago, and she's 3 and a half now, when I was pregnant with her and I was trying to research and prepare for what I was going to do with vaccines for her, the research is just so limited. So I'm so grateful when people do the deep work that you did that I don't have the patience for. I've got patience for other areas. So I'm so grateful when people like you do the deep work and really dive in. I know that there is some exploration of like a concept of called vaccinomics, where we're really trying to be more precise and like understand the individual and what will work for them. And if they're likely to have a good response to this particular vaccination, if they need to take it in a different order, if they need a smaller dose, a larger dose, so that it's effective for the individual and not just here's a blanket thing for everybody. I'm very excited about that. And it's got a long way to go. So I'm hopeful that at some point this podcast will be completely outdated and everybody will be getting really precise recommendations for them and their susceptibilities. But I know that there's a ton of questions that we've got for the community that Jody, especially as the mom here, wants to make sure we dive into. So let's go ahead and dive into some of these questions about PANS specifically. So the big question that we always have to ask is, are vaccines safe for PANS and PANDAS kiddos?
Good question. So vaccinations are inflammatory. That's non-negotiable. They are. In order to elicit an immune response, it takes a process to make an antibody that is inflammatory. So PANS, we have inflammation, and we can have other demographics of people with dealing with other things, Lyme disease, which can be part of PANDAS, PATANS.
Really any complex chronic illness, right? When there's an inflammatory process. Yeah,
exactly. So knowing that vaccines are inflammatory, are they safe? we have to have a level of awareness that we could increase inflammation in that body. So knowing that would be perhaps that would elicit a more profound or moderate adverse reaction as a result of being inflamed before having the vaccine. So this is where, because vaccines, what they use is called an adjuvant to stimulate the immune system, which is quite powerful. And the size of the vaccine will elicit a stronger response versus a smaller vaccine. So these are the conversations that, you know, I will have, or we need to have with parents to be it get the body to a place that can respond to the vaccine appropriately. If there's lots of inflammation already, the vaccine efficacy also may be lower. And this is even when we look at groups of people that are overweight, morbid obesity, that inflammation there actually interferes with the ability to make memory to the vaccine. So knowing that, even how efficacious the vaccine may be, might be less as a result of the state of the child and the inability to then therefore make memory. So I think that's basically, is it safe? Well, it's the inflammation that might be too much for that child. And therefore discussion of which one we're going to use, when we're going to use it, and go from there. And then using the tools to support the immune system so that it doesn't become too inflamed. And this is where we'll do like a pre and post vaccine support, supporting the immune system from that oxidative stress, you know, the immune system in terms of something like vitamin C, so we don't have a mass histamine response, which has been shown in one paper that I've looked at. The lack of vitamin C has mimicked shaken baby syndrome, which is due to a histamine response. And we all know that vitamin C is a mast cell stabilizer. So yeah, along with other things. So just, I think, and I have not had, knock on wood, I have not had any adverse reactions in my clinic. And be it, it's because of what we're doing and the mindfulness that we're trying to, what goal are we trying to achieve? And how then are we therefore going to achieve it? So it's supporting the immune system in a way that doesn't go overboard. There are some genetics that are coming, understanding if the body, be it's a child, adult, is going to be more inflamed or not. So it's interesting to look at those genetic SNPs to see, you know, be it knowing beforehand, if you're going to have more, elicit more of a more powerful inflammatory response or not. And then will you be able to reduce that or not? Yeah.
That's part of what would go into the vaccinomics, is like finding that precision. I know Jody's got a ton of questions for you, and I'm going to let her like jump in just a second, but I have to just to throw in as a naturopathic doctor, I recommend that people who are working with us, when they're actively flaring, that they avoid vaccinations if possible, because of all of the things that you just said. So that there's plenty of kids who get who have PANS and PANDAS who can tolerate vaccines, and it's not necessarily a problem. Also depends on where they're at in like the flare cycle. And so we typically recommend that people avoid vaccinations if possible while they're actively flaring. But it sounds like you've got some stuff, and I know we'll talk about it here in a little bit, like ways that you support people around vaccination. Have you found that people who are actively flaring, and for one reason or another, whether it be like a mandate from their local government that they have to get vaccines, have you found that you're able to use the supports that, like, and again, that we'll get to in a minute, to help support them so that it doesn't cause a flare? Or does it typically still cause a flare if they have to get one while they're actively flaring and can't get some sort of medical exemption?
Fortunately, I haven't had anyone have to have a vaccine during a flare, fortunately, but I have had sick adults that had to, and be it, you know, they have chronic, it's Lyme, or they have something that's going on, you know, even fibromyalgia or something, and they have been okay. They have been okay as a result of, but I haven't had a child in a flare, but I have had adults that aren't doing well going into having a vaccine, and they did just fine. Yeah. 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 That answers that question. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So I'm just curious, multi-part question here. What factors contribute to somebody negatively reacting to vaccines? And how do I know if my child is susceptible? Are there any signs that I should be looking for?
So you guys are in the United States and you start at birth, and there is no way you would know at birth to know if there's what the response is going to be. No one would know that. In Canada, we don't start until 2 months. Now, you also will do vaccines at 2 months. Some of the signs in those 2 months would be skin, if we have any eczema presentation, what's going on with our bowels. We have explosive bowels. Are we vomiting? Unconsolable. You know, there's which to me can sometimes mean pain, be it it's digestive pain, or there's systemic pain. So as the child ages, we're trying to look for signs, but really the thing is with the first vaccine, if the first vaccine is 2 months and they've never had a vaccine before, it's the first time that the body has received something like that. And so typically at the 2 month vaccine schedule, you wouldn't know because the body is like, okay, I've never seen this before. Fine. I'll deal with this, handle it. And then they get their 4 month vaccine then they get their 6 month vaccine. And so we're trying to then the health between that 2 month leading up to the 12 month vaccine is looking for, is there any atopic conditions that are developing? Because then I know there's a swing of the immune system, or it's sustaining actually a TH2 immune system versus swinging to that TH1. And so we'll get into infant immunity. Infants are born not knowing how to make memory to viruses and bacteria. They do not know how. That process starts to begin around 6 months, but really good between 9 and 12 months is when that process. And there's a negative feedback that occurs as a result of breastfeeding, as a result of interleukin-4 that's in the body circulating, which is really good for memory, cognition, that's the point of it, which down-regulates the ability to make memory. It down-regulates TH1. So it's sort of like a protective mechanism in play. So because eliciting an immune response, a memory, be it natural or to a vaccine, is very inflammatory. So the body turns that off. So if we have a body that we see that is a bit more inflamed via presentation of skin, we've got some atopy it's developing. It just seems the child seems to be reacting to things, be it it's the breast milk or it's the supplementation, then be it usually then we're going to see the 12 or 18 because it's a building block effect that's occurring. And there is an interesting paper that I just spoke at the last MAPS that's called criticality theory. And criticality theory is where when we vaccinate, or be it even a naturally acquired infection, we get an immune response. And when we have an immune response that's over and over and over and over again, quite close to one another, we hit a threshold where the immune system actually starts to then therefore attack itself. And it's due to what's called DOC8. And so it's very interesting, but we don't know when that criticality line is, that threshold is. So we don't know when it's coming. And be it pre that, we can see some signs that are occurring to know that maybe then we're going to hit that line. And that's when something occurs at that point. And that could be, again, you just got bit by a tick and that was it for you, or a vaccine, because both circumstances are very inflammatory. So I would say it's the skin ability. So sleep, so really trouble sleeping. We seem to be unconsolable, our bowel movements. And also if we're cyclic vomiting, so there's something dysregulated here, you're going to add something to that maybe just throw the body off. So those to me would be signs of knowing, okay, the system is telling me something and I need to unload some things here, be it the next time you receive either a naturally acquired infection or even a vaccine might tip you. So yeah. That's what I would be looking for.
And that's really a great place where, you know, homeopathy, which is obviously what our area of expertise is that can be really, really beneficial. Because what I'm hearing you say is that that point of criticality is different for different people and is affected both by the natural and the stimulated immune response. There's no way to predict at all when it's going to happen. So especially if you're having somebody who's got repeated recurrent infections when they're little, that those might be people that it would be really beneficial to address that susceptibility piece first. And that's what homeopathy comes in, is addressing that susceptibility before we go in and try to give these other things that could reach us to that point of criticality where we start to have more adverse responses. And what you said, you know, attacking this out yourself, that's what we see. It's the autoimmunity starting, that it can be triggered by that overactive immune activation that if we can dial things back and address some of that susceptibility to the increased risk of that reaction to vaccines and then also the repeated infections, that we could hopefully help people avoid some of the bigger issues.
Well, you nailed it when you said susceptibility. Absolutely. Yep.
Yep. That's our favorite word here on this podcast, is susceptibility. It comes up at least once, usually 10 times on each podcast episode, because that's really the truth of everything, right? That everything in health is about your individual susceptibility and using every tool that you can to address your susceptibility, removing obstacles to health and stimulating the body to heal. And then obviously living within the world that we have that may or may not require vaccinations.
This is why I love this conversation so much, because even with my own children, everything that you just explained was everything that happened with my younger daughter when she got her first set of vaccines. But it didn't happen with my older daughter, who's my PANS girl, until much later. And she had other. So even their susceptibility, same genetics, their susceptibility is completely different, and the way they had to be handled was completely different. So I love that, you know, there are actually people out there that are willing to have this conversation.
Yeah, it's tough, but it's just a reality. If we want to move forward and use the tools in medicine, we do have to talk about both sides. And that's from its safety to efficacy. We do. And in all forms. Yeah.
So you've already started to dive into a little bit on like how some people might go about deciding whether to vaccinate or whether to pause vaccinating. So is there anything other than seeing those signs of inflammation in your system or seeing recurrent repeated infections? Are there any other things that people should really consider when they're deciding whether to even give vaccinations or whether they should maybe pause vaccinations in a child who's gotten a diagnosis of PANS PANDAS or showing signs of it, or potentially autism as well?
When I have a conversation with parents about decision making, I always actually start with the infection first. So do you understand what Haemophilus influenza type B is? Do you understand what tetanus is, or pertussis, whooping cough? Because we come at it a lot from the perspective of the vaccine itself versus coming from the infection side first. So do you know what those infections are? And then therefore, why is there a vaccine for that? We can put the vaccine aside, but helping making decision if you're going to get a vaccine means, do you understand the infection it's for, and do you want a bit of protection towards
understanding the risk? Understand the risk.
Because people are like, I don't even know, like hepatitis B, like what if we go to Mexico? Okay, what if you go to Mexico? You're not going to get hepatitis B from water. So there's this confusion. And so they're like, oh, but yeah, but that's why I got it when I went to Mexico. No, you got hep A and hep B. Yeah. So this is, you know, like, well, hepatitis B, I mean, so that's in the United States, you do it at birth. What's interesting, in Canada, we don't do it till 2 months. Most provinces don't do it till grade 6. Mm-hmm. So just even understanding the infection first to, and then move on to what vaccines are we going to do, and then have a conversation. That's how I formulate our conversations, because people don't, they don't understand the infection. Like, I don't understand why I'm getting this. Okay, well, let's understand why it's offered. What's the infection? Is there a risk of contracting hepatitis B? Is there a risk of attracting polio or rotavirus? Let's talk about that, or tetanus. So then be it, they're like, no, I don't understand. I'm not going to do this one because of no risk, et cetera, or there's no way to contract, et cetera. And then you've narrowed in potentially which ones are you going to vaccinate for. Now let's talk about those vaccines. And I think that is a better perspective that's been more helpful in terms of making a decision for families. So it sort of, we're going to weed out what we actually want to do first. And then now we have the child in front of us, the age, their health history, pregnancy and labor are important to me of how that went. And then if you've had any antibiotics for that kiddo, how's their gut health? If they get infected, how long does it take for them to resolve from that? How many times have you had Tylenol? And all of those then are important to me. And then we move forward. How strong is the immune system? Can they elicit an immune response? Will they respond to a vaccine to make antibodies? Depends how old they are, actually. And so then we go from there, because what's interesting is in the United States, you guys go back to work. Mamas can go back to work at 3 months. In Canada, it's 12 to 18 months. Now, the United States recognized that mamas were going to go back to work at 3 months back in the day. So public health then was like, well, we're going to have all of these babies that are not breastfed going to daycare. Let's create a vaccine schedule. So 2, 4, 6 months was born to support those infants going to daycare because mom is not breastfeeding. But so then a schedule happened, which is very easy to follow. And I appreciate a schedule because then there isn't errors that are made, because everyone knows what the schedule is and you're dealing with millions of people, then you can bounce around from public health agencies or you move and everyone knows what they should do so they don't make an error and your child doesn't get the same vaccine 5 times. They shouldn't have based on what the schedule. Then with that is the world then copied the CDC. We have Dr. Stanley Plotkin that then visited public health agencies around the globe. And now the schedules, which are a little bit different from different public health agencies, but relatively the same. And that's where that occurred, based on mama's not breastfeeding, based on babies going to daycare for that window of time. Because long-term memory comes out of basically after that 9-month window piece. That's where long-term memory comes from. So we have a short-term memory that occurs from 2 to 6 months. You're getting through a window of time is what we're doing, short-term. And that immunity from what you did between 2 and 6 months is going to be gone relatively soon thereafter. Be it it's 6 months. I mean, we don't know because no one checks immune status. There's no way to know for sure. But we repeat everything that we've done between that 2-6 mark at 12 months, or it's at 15 or 18 months. We repeat it all. And that is where longevity comes from, because then the next set of vaccines typically is until the kiddo is entering kindergarten and then years later, grade school. So part of the age of the child also really comes into, it's part of the conversation, is the age, risk. What's happening? Is there smokers in the house? Because then you have increased risk of contracting Haemophilus influenza type B, HIB. Is there house crowding? Are you traveling? Are you going to daycare? Do you live on a farm? All of these components then increase your risk to contract, but then also the susceptibility of that infection hurting that child or not is also part of the equation too. So I mean, that's why it's, you know, it's a big conversation.
Well, you're going through all of this complexity. And like, obviously, this is all the stuff that I think about. Jody can tell you, we talk about this type of stuff all the time, which is why I'm so grateful that you're here to have this conversation with us. And because it's so complex, it's also why a lot of people don't do all of the work that you have done to really fully understand it, because it's messy. It is messy because the truth is, again, susceptibility matters, and it's all of those things. So,
naturopathic doctors, one of our principles is do no harm. So I take my oath very, very seriously. I don't pick and choose, cherry pick of what I think, you know, they mean do no harm. Okay. So to do no harm means I have to have a conversation with you, be it it's tough conversation, which unfortunately it's got to that point, to know what is best for you or what is best for your child. And so you need to be informed before you consent to utilizing this tool. Yeah.
Yeah. So I know one question that, Jody, I'm sure you're dying to ask, and I'm going to ask it for you anyway, because I'm going to jump ahead because I think this is vital. Yeah. Are there ways to know how much protection a vaccine is going to give somebody with a misguided immune response? I can't tell you how many kiddos I have seen come through my practice that didn't realize that they had primary immune deficiency until they got diagnosed with PANS and got all this testing. We're seeing all these symptoms and then found out, oh, we don't have any antibodies, but we don't have any antibodies because our body can't produce antibodies. So is there any way to know if somebody is, how much like protection they're going to get if they're having this misdirected immune response?
Such a tough question, because we have not even established what a threshold of antibodies equates protection.
Yeah.
Don't even know. So what's interesting is that we have this, because you, that would be, you can't test out efficacy of vaccines, meaning if you get a vaccine or a group of individuals enroll into testing, they receive a vaccine, and then you're going to put it to the test, meaning I'm going to inoculate you with that infection. You can do it to animals all day long, but to humans, we don't. What we do is they get the vaccine and then go out in the world and then see if you contract the infection in that way. But you might just missed it the entire time and didn't contract it, and therefore it was efficacious because you didn't contract it. But who knows if you actually contracted it or not. So, right. And what we also don't do is, epidemiology is not a strong area of medicine. When a child presents with a sniffle or a cough, we do not test them for what they specifically have. What we say is, oh, maybe it's a common cold. The triage is, if you go see a medical doctor, is, well, maybe it's just a common cold, or maybe it's just a virus. Just go home, or here's antibiotics, here's amoxicillin, and go home. And then the infection resolves. Maybe you had pertussis, maybe you had Hib, maybe you had pneumococcal. Who knows what you just had? But we don't surveil there's the surveillance system of all these infections that which we can vaccinate for. We do not test people to see if they have it. And if they're vaccinated, perhaps the vaccine didn't work for them, or they're unvaccinated, and therefore that's why they got the infection. We don't have good numbers. Pertussis is one thing that the CDC does do. And those, so then they do have rates of pertussis annually, and they look at vaccinated, partial, and unvaccinated, and they don't know the vaccine schedule. And it's about, for actually diagnosing pertussis, it's about 20,000 people per year in the United States of 300 million people. 20,000. That's actually diagnosed. But what about people who had sort of lingering symptoms, could have been pertussis? So that number is probably much bigger. And then they take who's been vaccinated and not, and so forth. And within that, the CDC states, it looks to be, based on numbers, 50% whom have vaccinated or partially vaccinated have contracted pertussis and were able to be diagnosed as having whooping cough. So, I mean, this is the thing, is we don't know, is how efficacious is the vaccine to, did it work for that child? And did you elicit an immune response to protect you? What is that threshold? We're still unsure of what the threshold is to equate protection, because we won't test it to know either, because that doesn't work in medicine. You can't try to hurt someone in that moment. Here, get the vaccine and I'm going to spray you with pertussis and see if this works or not. Not going to happen, for obvious reasons. So it's, you know, the thing is with infants, though, really up until 9 months, you are unable, your body is built to not make memory. Your body, though, can kill things. An infant has an innate immune system that can kill things, but it doesn't make memory because it's built to not to. So you are going to get sick. That is going to happen. And you're going to get sick from the exact same thing probably over and over and over again, because you're not supposed to make memory yet. You're supposed to be protected by mom, who supplies passive immunity. That's how nature intended it. So then based on after that point, then, and when we give the vaccines at 12 months, that's where the memory is happening, is the 12 months. Now, can you? Well, what's happened before then, has that reduced your ability to make memory at 12 months? That's a question also, unsure if our decision-making within here has reduced that ability from C-section, not breastfed, antibiotics, and be it the vaccines over and over and over again, has that reduced that TH1 ability leading into that 12-month, 9-month onward threshold? And so there's all these variables that play into the conversation that did we reduce your ability, not because of your genetics, but our decision-making. And now onward, you're not able to, because we are not ever, will there ever be any research done on taking a group of pure unvaccinated people and vaccinate them at 12 months onward or 9 months onward and compare them to 2, 4, 6 months onward. That will not occur. That will never happen for research to know and to explain. Yeah, the immune system shift is important for us to be part of our conversation, because immunologists and public health need to start having conversations. And be it, is our timing off on doing these things? The timing was there for kiddos that are not breastfed going to daycare. What about the ones that are being breastfed? And is breast milk interfering for baby to make memory, which it does for pertussis, interestingly enough. So then we have these unintended consequences that we're creating. So, but in order to make sure that we all stay on track and be organized, we have one schedule is what we have. Perhaps there should be three schedules based on what you're doing, or variants of those schedules to support every single human body for better vaccine efficacy as well, because things that we're doing might be reducing efficacy, prolonging the ability to make memory. But is there immune insufficiency? Is we aren't going to be able to know that also before really 9 months, because you are immune. You aren't supposed to be making memory. You're not supposed to. You're built, locked in, teach to. And that has been defined in the literature. And they're therefore looking for novel Th1 stimulating factors in vaccinations, because that's how the body works.
Yeah. So ultimately, what I'm hearing from you is that not only is there not a way to guarantee how much protection you're going to get from a vaccine for somebody who has autoimmunity or a misdirected immune response, but there's no way to tell for any human being, again, because there's all of these individual mitigating factors that could contribute to how your body's going to respond to an individual vaccination.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. It's a N of one every single time. And yeah. You know, and then be it when you have a patient in front of you, are we going to be doing blood work for a 2-month-old to see? But then again, I know that you're not built to make memory as a 12-month-old can. So I already know that there's immunodeficiency, but really it's just the development hasn't occurred yet. The immune system is developing. And can we teeter it even more as a result of our decision-making? Yeah, we can even teeter it even more. So then you are further away from making immunity. That Th1 isn't coming in to development as a result of a multitude of decisions that we're making. Yeah.
So you've mentioned the schedule multiple times, and I'm curious. I think a whole lot of people are curious if vaccines are causing more issues today because of the schedule or the ingredient. It sure does seem like they're causing a whole lot more issues, but I also acknowledge that we have a whole lot more ability to communicate with each other. So what are your thoughts there?
The more vaccines means more inflammation. And, you know, when we look back in the 80s and people want to pin MMR vaccine as an issue, MMR was in the 80s and MMR is today. And so I don't think that MMR is the problem child. It is, because we see when people see issues or adverse reactions, usually be it at 6 months, or it's usually post MMR. So then we pin MMR, but it is what is occurring before that and the amount that's happening before that. And eliciting immune response is very inflammatory on an infant that doesn't know how to deal with that inflammation. However, in the 80s, we did vaccines and we didn't see what we're seeing today. So there comes again that criticality threshold, that criticality theory comes in terms of a threshold. Where is the threshold? Well, in the 80s, we didn't hit that threshold. So, I mean, I had the DTaP, the OPV, oral poliovirus, which doesn't have aluminum in it, and the MMR vaccine. So to me, means there is a balancing act that can happen. We have to have a conversation on how much is being used and can the human body handle it. And if you're a C-section baby, not breastfed baby, brings into that conversation for that infant. And if we, and this is where people will, you know, my kiddo's fine. Well, my kiddo's fine. My kiddo's fine. Okay, well, we have to then dig into all the parameters, I think. And so be it, yeah, your genetics, you're not programmed to be more inflamed. You have those off switches. Some people don't have those off switches. And be it, the body had all the nutrients that it needed to help. It was able to turn off. There was an acute response, but not chronic. You are being breastfed, so you are getting those things from mama. You were vaginal birth versus C-section. All those things play in. So there is more happening today. There is more inflammation as a result. And then we have infant bodies that I think aren't able to handle it due to all these things. And mama's health, unfortunately, through pregnancy added. Obviously, it's the passed down effect as well. So we have all of these things. This is why if you have as an ND, we have mama who is going to get pregnant, supporting her before that, supporting her through pregnancy and all those things leading up, and then talking about labor and what we can do, interventions, and advocating for yourself and reducing is less is more when it comes to pregnancy and labor, so that we have a thriving kiddo and reducing probability of things that may occur. Even food introduction to kiddos can be some things that we can do better with food introduction and reduce colic and reduce things in terms of gut health. All of those factors, because we've changed how we've done things from the 80s to the 90s, to now in the 2000s, of how we've decided to do things for kiddos, and more is being done. And that includes vaccines, but that also includes interventions. It also includes antibiotics. It also includes Tylenol. All those things, we have more all wrapped into that. In pregnancy, we're doing more. Yes, even vaccines in pregnancy, be it medications, more medications are being used in pregnancy than before, from even antidepressant medications, you name it. So it's the load. It is absolutely the load. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Bean, you've given us a lot of things that people can really think about when it comes to choosing the right approach for them for vaccination, things that they can bring to their providers to ask them about when discussing vaccinations. I'm curious if we can shift gears just a little bit to talk a little about how you support people who has chosen to get vaccinations to help them reduce their risk of having any adverse events. I know you and I have talked previously that you do use a lot of homeopathy in helping that with that protocol, and that we acknowledge that people who are using homeopathy as their primary method of treatment, or that they're using it as a mainstay, even if it's not the only thing, that if they're using chronic classical homeopathy, that the homeopathic side would not apply to them because that could interfere with their response. And that ultimately is going to give them the most protection for their individual unique susceptibility. But I know that there's a lot of things that you do outside of that as well to help people support themselves and reduce risk. So share with us what you can about what some of the things you do.
Absolutely. So glutathione, number one, glutathione. And that's always sometimes can be a struggle to get kiddos to do. But if we have an infant, it's usually they'll do it. So a good liposomal. I start 2 weeks before the vaccine and I go 2 weeks afterwards. Some people might do 2 or 3 days. I start 2 weeks beforehand, first off, to know that the things that I'm giving the child, they're not reacting to it. They can handle it totally. Because let's say I start 2 days before the vaccine to get the vaccine, and it's like it was actually the product and not the vaccine. I don't know which one. So we start 2 weeks beforehand. So glutathione is number one, vitamin D, number two, vitamin C, number three. Now I'm now going to be adding in SPMs, and I haven't before, but for that.
Do you hear what SPMs are? So it's for anybody who's listening who doesn't know what that is.
So it's coming, so it's from fish oil, but it's more a different structure. But it's from that SPMs are helping at a stronger, helping with inflammation at a stronger level is what they are. There's not many companies that do SPMs, but it's working on certain inflammatory pathways. And so this is where SPMs have come beginning, really, they haven't been here that long, I think. But they're really coming to the conversation in terms of inflammation for patients, be it post-infection, even let's say post-surgery afterwards. just to help with those inflammatory pathways. So that's something that I'm going to start to introduce more now is SPMs after just doing some more, actually from the last MAPS conference, conversations mm-hmm. around inflammation. I also do use, I want to do drainage. I want to do support the body with drainage, and be it different companies and products, which are typically a blend of homeopathic remedies in one. But I think drainage in that perspective, working on that extracellular matrix component is important pre and post. And even kiddos that are presenting with a bit of eczema, I find mm-hmm. that our 2 week leading up starts to improve. So then mm-hmm. we're reducing that inflammation load by using drainage and those nutraceuticals. And then, I do use some specific homeopathic remedies, but that's essentially the essence. If we're doing MMR, I will also tie in vitamin A with that. Just one big dose on the day of, and I usually will do 2 weeks later. We will also do that. Then with that is if we see something beyond a fever, beyond soreness, then we have some tools in place, and be it we're going to give the kiddos some charcoal to help reduce inflammatory components such as IL-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha is what we're thinking about, is reducing those components so it doesn't lead into a chronic effect. So supporting the body that way.
One quick question before I let Jody ask the last mom question that we have here. With the approach where you're bringing in more SPMs, I'm curious if you suspect that there might be less of an immune response, like less of a immune memory formation because of the reduction of inflammation, because as you said, inflammation is a necessary part of developing that immune response. So it's going to be interesting to see how much, like I can understand wanting to reduce the inflammation going in. And I'm curious if there would be any mitigation, or you would want to maybe reduce mitigation after, or if that's not much of a concern for you.
No, it's more modulation versus suppression. And so with all the nutraceuticals, it's modulation and no suppression. Even glutathione actually has specifically been looked at to not intervene at all in memory formation, because it does help with immune. This is why I use it, which is it does support with memory, helps with oxidative damage. Gentle chelator is also while use it, but it's more so for the immune response. But no, it would be modulation versus suppression for all of these things at a still at a level that is helpful to elicit immune response, but not as though we're suppressing it. No. And one other thing is that I'd like for people to do is Fiji water. Fiji water for the specific form of silica that's in it that helps to bind to aluminum. It's aluminum that we want to help support the body to eliminate. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So I, as a mom, feel like I have I kind of touched on this earlier, I have so much trauma from how this conversation went with my kids, especially my PANS kids or my PANS kiddo. So I feel like anytime I'm in appointment with their pediatrician, I try to ask questions and I get just met with this very stern matter of fact, this is how it is. I want to have a productive conversation, but I have no idea how to even start that conversation. Do you have any advice for moms to approach our providers in a productive manner?
I hear you. And it's so unfortunate. I have attended conferences that are taught by the CDC or BCCDC. And it's interesting because the presenters are teaching the audience of matter-of-fact language, and they gaslight, you know, they'll bring up Dr. Andrew Wakefield, they'll bring up people that they'll use as examples. And it's really disheartening to watch, because it's like we are going 20 steps back. We're not moving forward. So they're coming into the office with you already having attended something like this, given permission to talk to you this way. I think starting the conversation, that is, you have to work up to it, maybe more gently, of just, you know, recognizing that they're the expert. You know, you're the expert here, you're the pediatrician. And I'm just really confused in some areas and I just can't seem to find anywhere. And I'm coming here because you're the expert and I'm really hoping that you can help me understand something here. So you're starting the conversation that way, then moving into like, so why are people talking about this? Why are people saying X? And so be it you're giving them permission or the opportunity to explain something that you're seeing, be it it's not particularly your child that you're asking about, but it's like, why are people talking about this? I don't know if you can help me understand this because I'm really curious to understand. So it's not, they're not going to be feeling defensive in that moment because you're not pinpointing, okay, what are you going to do for my child and how are you going to help my child? But I just want to know about this. So be it, I can be prepared and prevent something that a lot of parents are talking about and how can we do this would be my suggestion. Because it needs to, you need to warm up and you can't be head on with, you know, the questions because you're going to be met with deflection, defensiveness, and already given the permission to deflect you and, not agree with anything that you've just said because they're coming from a conference where the people on stage are talking like that. And that's what's happening within this conversation. And it is literally giving them the green light to talk to you in such a way around this specific topic, which is not getting us anywhere. So that's why I do conferences to remind the audience that you cannot talk to patients this way and you will create hesitancy if you do. So I have seen a bit of change in the approach, the softening approach a little bit. I have started to see that. It's going to take a bit. And also, if your provider does not know the answer, they will also deflect. It is not the time for them to say, I really don't know. It's more of, nope, that's not right. That's incorrect. And that's what you're met with. Yeah.
From one provider to another who is willing to say, I don't know, let me go find an answer. I have a lot of gratitude for that.
Yep. I learned from my patients and they have stimulated things of conversation for me. I didn't know I needed to look into. So yeah, I'm grateful for my patients for that. Yep.
Yeah. My patients have made me 1000% a better doctor. I've helped a lot more people because I've listened to my patients. So.
Totally. Yeah. So it's also uniquely to that person too. If that pediatrician has no space of learning more, don't think they need to learn more. What they know is what they know, and that's just how it is. You be tough to crack that individual to have them, you know, look further because they're like, no, you're wrong.
Well, I think that's, you know, one of the neat things about this conversation in itself, because as a mom, I'm always learning. I did not know that homeopathy was even, I didn't know it existed until I was 35 years old, I think. And until today, I didn't realize that, I guess I've never thought about it, that you can go to, there are providers that are out there that will have this conversation with you. You were talking about doing a vaccine appointment or vaccine consult or whatever it is. It never dawned on me that there are providers out there that are willing to sit down and have that conversation even before I have the child, or if problems start happening to where, you know, I can go and talk to a professional that's willing to have an actual conversation with me. So just even knowing that is out, that exists, is, it's really nice. It's beneficial, really helpful thing to us moms.
No, and I think there's more of us that are starting to do this because of the great need. When I started, I don't know if there was anyone else that was formulating specifically a vaccine consultation, but I saw the need and that it required its own consultation. It really, because it comes up in conversation. I'm like, well, we really only have 15 more minutes, but this is a conversation that should be an hour. And that's also why I built my vaccine webinar series. There's 8 of them, and vaccineoptimization.com. I mean, that is in a nutshell, what I want all of us to do and be able to provide for is vaccine optimization. And that means so many different things, from our language to having conversations, safe place, supporting immune system. I mean, that's, to me, is what that is. And so I created them because it's there's I don't know what you don't know, and you don't know what you don't know. And what is it? What do you want to know? And so, you know, do you want to know about infant immunity? Do you want to know about the viruses we vaccinate against or the bacteria? Do you want to know about aluminum? So do you want to know how to raise a thriving child, which is what I talk about in one full webinar? What are those things? Because again, raising a thriving child, are they therefore then susceptible to something that this child over here is susceptible to because they're not thriving? So it's the whole picture piece. But yeah, I mean, I think the language around the vaccination has certainly taken a turn. COVID has stimulated. It's been a stimulus, certainly, for conversation for a lot of people. It was unfortunate. That's what it took for, but we should have always have had this conversation, but that's more and more people are like, yeah, I want to have a dialogue around this. I have a right to have a conversation and know more. And you do have a right to know more. You do. So you should have someone that should be open to having that with you.
So speaking about knowing more, I love that you've got the webinars on your vaccineoptimization.com. We'll make sure we've got a link to it in the show notes so people can access it really easily. Just a quick question about that. Is that more geared toward parents trying to make decisions or providers, or is it a little bit for both?
Both. It's both. I mean, this conversation, I provide all the literature, all of the, and unfortunately it can be too much, but this topic has, and we're talking about vaccines. We cannot be in a, you know, a, I want you to have the literature. I want you to have the language. I want you to have the depth of information. And unfortunately, we have to go there of depth, and you're going to have to, that brain is going to be turned on when you're listening. This is not just, we're talking about colors and shoes. Like this is, we have to go deep with this so that you are prepared with the language that, you know, you're asking sophisticated questions because now you've gone a certain depth. And so now you can really narrow in what is it that you want to know. And you can have that language to express mm-hmm. yourself because you understand more than you had previously. And it's supposed to stimulate deeper conversations as well. And so some topics, I just scratched the surface because maybe you want to go down that specific one or that specific one. And so it could be 20 hours. Really, I left a lot out because it's just too much, but I want to stimulate that. And so, yes, it's technical. I'm talking about, you know, immunity, physiology. I get into those, but you need to understand even from what an antigen to an antibody is, if you're going to start having a conversation about this and wanting and having people listen to you. But if you start saying things that are totally wrong, you lost your audience. And so that's why it's that way.
No, I appreciate it because it's beneficial. I can't tell you how many parents will ask, especially in the pandas community, that they need to talk to somebody who is not as informed as they are as individuals, because, you know, these are people who come with like lots of research and they spend like they get their mom MD, right? And so I think it's great that it's something that could be beneficial both for parents and that they could use to share with a provider who is interested in learning more and to getting a more in-depth conversation. Yeah. Are there any other courses that either you have or that were some, maybe somebody else wrote that you really appreciate that you would like to share as just like good things that people could lean into more, or help them with their decision-making?
I appreciate the book, The Unvaccinated Child, written by two naturopathic doctors. I really like that book. It is, it's not thick. It's a great size. It goes through each infection, which I love. Every provider should have that on their shelf, and it gives you solutions. And that's what I love about it is, for me, I'm a solution person. You can tell me X, Y, Z is good and bad. Okay. So what am I going to do now? What? Yeah. I won't give me that piece. So that's, they give that. They talk about the infection, get to know the infection. And then if your kiddo presents with the infection, what are you going to do? Because even though you've been vaccinated, it's not 100% efficacious. So then what are you going to do? So that, I like that book for that. Diving deep. Dr. Cowan has the vaccine autoimmunity book, and I think that gets into physiology, which I really like. And I buy these books simply just for their references. Like, what are you referencing? And then I look at those references. Those two books, I would say, are a good start for also not inflammatory language. I'm not for inflammatory language on either side. I am for just critical thinking, directness, leave the emotion at the door and let's just dive into the research and have a conversation. That I really like. That's what those two books to me give. Yeah, I would say those are a good starting point. There's, depending on what person wants, there's, you know, there's deeper books. But those are really two good ones to own. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And then finally, other than vaccineoptimization.com, how could people get in touch with you if they want to learn more about you or potentially consult with you? You are in Canada and I believe you can only consult with Canadians, but you can do like a one-time consultation for people who are in another province as well. Mm-hmm. I think you shared. So if that's totally incorrect, please correct me, but how can people find you?
Yeah. So my clinic is TaylorMadeWellness.com. And then my personal website is drtaylorbean.com. I'm also on Instagram. Lots going on over there. Dr. Taylor Bean for the Instagram piece. Now, in terms of consultation, I do see people within Canada, within the United States. To answer your questions, if there's going to be any treatment or suggestions for pre-post-vaccine protocol, I need them to have a provider and I send that plan to the provider and the provider can implement the plan. So I don't treat outside of the province, support or give dosages and so forth, but it's more of, what do you want to know? I'll answer your question. Yeah,
strictly consultation.
It's strictly consultation. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, we'll make sure we put links to all of those things, the books that you shared, your websites, your Instagram, everything. We'll have that in our show notes. Dr. Bean, I cannot thank you enough for the time that you've given us and the generosity that you've shared with this community. And I appreciate that you didn't dumb anything down for people too. Like that, like I said, you and I have both learned so much from the community that we've served. And so I know that people appreciate it. And if anybody's got questions about the things that Dr. Bean did not dumb down, you can definitely let us know and we can do our best to make sure that we clarify any of that for you. Dr. Bean, thank you again so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for Pans and Pandas throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.